All right, my notes begin on page 17 of your handbook, and this is going to be one of those occasions when I kind of do more talking around the notes than I do talking through the notes. So you're going to want to probably have a pen or pencil handy. We need the brethren to gather around Todd Mitchell over here and lay hands on him, and when he starts to drift off, give him a good shake and see if we can keep him awake through this session. I'm going to be talking to you about a Christian theology of culture. Right off the bat, I think you can recognize that I've got a built-in handicap when discussing a topic like this, simply because the Bible nowhere directly defines or even directly addresses the topic of culture. And so everything we learn scripturally, we learn by way of inference. Now, that is not to say that there is nothing that we can learn. It is to say that we need to be a little bit careful in how we go about this. At the beginning, I have a short discussion here on the question, what is culture? Somebody's given an informal definition of culture and said, well, culture is just the way we do things around here. And that sort of works, but the moment we try to get any more complicated than that, we run into some divergent views. Let me spend just a moment on H. Richard Niebuhr, who's the first writer that I mention here. I give the name of his volume, Christ and Culture. That volume stands sort of as a unit with several other books that Niebuhr wrote. By the way, this is not Reinhold Niebuhr. This is his brother, Richard Niebuhr. The four books that stand together are Christ and Culture, The Social Sources of Denominationalism, The Kingdom of God in America, and Radical Monotheism. What Niebuhr is doing is to begin with a social scientific definition of culture. Now, there are two social sciences, sociology and anthropology, that attempt to deal with the topic of culture. And the social sciences have a built-in difficulty, and the difficulty is this. Their science is defined as a science that examines culture, but their science is also a science that is supposed to define what culture is. Well, how do you know how to define it by examining it unless you know what to examine first? So there's a built-in contradiction here that I think really weakens all putatively scientific studies of culture. That is to say, I don't think that sociology and anthropology are the place to go for an understanding of what culture is and how culture works. But Niebuhr begins with a more or less social scientific definition of culture, and his book, Christ and Culture, is a sort of a schema of the way that different Christians have tried to approach culture. And the two extremes in his schema, on the one end, would be the Anabaptist view of culture, or what he thinks of as the Anabaptist view of culture. There have been Anabaptists who have responded to him, who have said that he didn't represent them very well. But essentially, in the Anabaptist view, he sees that version of Christianity being pitted against culture. He sees it as very culture-denying, culture-rejecting, as the kind of mentality that attempts to opt out of culture, to exempt itself from culture. And I think that he would probably view traditional fundamentalism as another manifestation of that same kind of thing. At the opposite end of the spectrum, he looks at Protestant liberalism. And in Protestant liberalism, which is very pantheistic, essentially because God is so immanent in the cultural process, culture is God, and God is culture. And so the forms of Christianity, from a liberal point of view, are subordinated to the surrounding culture. So with the extreme of Anabaptism, you have Christianity against culture. Niebuhr would say at the extreme of liberalism, you have Christianity being subordinated to culture. And in between, he has a number of other perspectives that he discusses. Those two define the extremes. What I'm going to suggest is that Niebuhr, because he begins with a social scientific definition of culture, makes a fundamental mistake. And that mistake is the mistake of thinking that you have to have a specific attitude toward culture in general. What I'm going to argue is that there is no such thing as culture in general. Rather, there are specific cultures, and there are specific ways in which each culture manifests itself, and that nobody, absolutely nobody, is completely against all culture, and that nobody, absolutely nobody, is completely subservient to all culture. That is to say, we all do picking and choosing. We all make choices about the way that we are going to appropriate specific cultures and specific cultural phenomena or manifestations. Let me go down the rest of the list here on page 17 and give you just a little bit of an overview of the way that other people have handled the topic of culture. Matthew Arnold was a British literary critic during the 19th century. He's very famous for his poem entitled Dover Beach, in which he is lamenting the erosion of the age of faith. He's lamenting the fact that civilization, society, is no longer dominated by faith or belief. Not that he valued Christianity or Christian faith per se, but because of the fact that faith is evaporating, he sees this as a threat to civilization. If faith goes, then all of our morals, all of our standards are going to be cast to the four winds, and there's the danger that nothing will survive except barbarity. And his solution is to see culture as the savior for civilization. And when he says culture, what he has in mind is high culture, arts, sciences, letters. A modern-day version of Matthew Arnold is Jacques Barzun. And you can pick up a copy of his book, and it's a very good book. By the way, both of these books, Culture and Anarchy by Matthew Arnold and The Culture We Deserve by Jacques Barzun, very good books. Barzun, like Arnold, is looking at contemporary culture, only he, by the way, was, I think, provost at University of Columbia. He's 100 years later now, looking at the same process that Arnold was looking at, and he sees 100 years more erosion, and effectively what Barzun is saying is that we are in really deep trouble. And it's a book that is well worth reading. It's a book that is well worth understanding. Other authors who try to make some of the same case, Richard Mitchell, Neil Postman, Alan Bloom, I think most of you somewhere along the line have stumbled across The Closing of the American Mind, and in a different sort of way in some of his writings, Mortimer Adler. Okay, all of those are looking at high culture as something that is going to hold our civilization together, and they are distressed by the fact that high culture is being taken apart and rendered meaningless. The next author that I mention is T.S. Eliot in his essay, Notes Towards the Definition of Culture. I think that Eliot represents an advance upon all of the above. T.S. Eliot, as you may know, was an engineer who became a poet. He was actually trained in engineering in St. Louis, Missouri, as he went further and further into philosophy and then into poetry. He transferred his residence to Great Britain, eventually became a subject of the crown, and was awarded the Nobel Prize in literature. His early poetry was very anti-Christian, and then he converted to Christianity, now not to what we think, not to American evangelical Christianity, but at least to a generalized belief in the Lord Jesus Christ as Savior. And after that, his poetry becomes much more of an exposition of Christianity, and he became very, very concerned with the relationship between Christianity and society, Christianity and culture. And in this particular essay, what he's arguing is that every culture is, he says, the incarnation of a religion. And it's an extended discussion. He's not so much providing a definition of culture. Rather, he's providing some preliminary considerations that will help us to zero in on what a culture is. And I think he's absolutely correct when he argues that every culture incarnates a religion, or perhaps we could say more broadly, a religious worldview, sometimes perhaps even an anti-religious worldview. There is a long tradition. Oh, but let me mention a couple of other names here with T.S. Eliot, names with which you ought to be familiar. Richard Weaver is a very important writer from the point of view of what you could call literary criticism, a literary critical evaluation of culture. In fact, if you only read one book during the rest of this year, it ought to be Richard Weaver, Ideas Have Consequences. That's probably, next to the Bible, the most important book that you're going to have on your shelf. Other writers include Russell Kirk, G.K. Chesterton, Blaise Pascal, C.S. Lewis. Okay, they're not all saying the same thing. They're not all taking the same perspective, but they're all wrestling either with culture or with cultural phenomena, with the idea in mind that culture really does manifest or incarnate a religious point of view. The fifth writer that I've listed here is Henry R. Van Til, The Calvinistic Concept of Culture. This is actually a history of several Calvinist theologians who have thought and written on the topic of culture. The Calvinist theologians, the Reformed theologians, have a sort of a tradition of reflection upon cultural issues. Abraham Kuyper is widely known for his writings on culture and civilization. J. Gresham Machen has a short essay entitled Christianity and Culture that is worth its weight in gold. It is an absolutely wonderful essay, well worth your reading. You can find it reprinted in a number of sources. More recently, the Christian Reconstructionists have picked up the ball on cultural considerations, because of the fact that they are post-millennialists and they believe that they ought to be reshaping culture along the lines of whatever the millennium is supposed to look like, in their view. But at least they're giving serious reflection to culture. And one of the more interesting contemporary Reformed writers that you're going to pick up is Douglas Wilson. Are you acquainted with Douglas Wilson? Some of you knew St. Andrew's College in Moscow, Idaho. He's got a magazine called Credenda Agenda in which he regularly takes pot shots at fundamentalists and at dispensationalists. But you know what? You're going to love him anyway, because even when he's wrong, he says it well. He's worth reading. He's well worth reading. You ought to be on his mailing list. You ought to visit his blog occasionally. All of this gets us to the point. What can we say? By the way, the Calvinistic view of culture really stems from what is often called the cultural mandate in Genesis chapter 1. You may want to take a glance at this. Genesis 1:26. And God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air and over the cattle and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. And here it is, God blessed them, and God said unto them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the fowl of the air, over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. This command to fill the earth, to subdue the earth, and to exercise dominion is usually called the cultural mandate. Now, let me make just an editorial comment or two here, and let me begin with a statement that some of you may find alarming. I don't think there is such a thing as a cultural mandate. And the first reason that I believe that is because I don't think there's a mandate here. This is often called a command. I don't think it's a command at all. It's a blessing. Okay, now grammatically, the verbs that are used here are imperative verbs. But imperative verbs have a number of functions, only one of which is to express command. Another function of imperatives is to express blessing. So you're at the grocery store, and you're going through the checkout line, and the girl behind the counter, as she's ringing up your groceries, says to you, have a nice day. Do you say to her, who are you to order me around? Well, of course you don't. You recognize she's not giving you an order. She's not telling you that you must have a good day no matter what. She is wishing you a good day. She is expressing a blessing upon you. Or you've got Mr. Spock on the Starship Enterprise, and he does his, you know, Vulcan symbol thing, and he says, "Live long and prosper." And you can imagine Captain Kirk saying, "Spock, are you ordering me around?" Or McCoy saying, "Don't give me that order." No, it's not an order, it's not a command, it's a blessing. Okay, so blessings are expressed as imperatives. Why would we think that this is a blessing rather than a command? Let me give you two reasons. Number one, it's because of what the verse says. Notice, "And God blessed them and said." It doesn't say God commanded them. It says God blessed them. That might give us an indication that this is a blessing rather than a commandment. Second consideration is, if you look up a little earlier in the context, you will find some of the exact same language being used with respect to non-rational, non-spiritual creatures. Verse 22, God is speaking about the birds and the fish. "And God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters and the seas and let fowl multiply in the earth." Is God giving a command to the fish and to the birds? Does God ever give commands to non-rational, non-spiritual creation? The answer is no. Only in the most metaphorical sense does God do that. So, if he's not commanding the fish, if he's not commanding the birds, what's he doing? He's blessing them. And if he's doing that to the fish and to the birds, then all the likelihood is that just a few verses later on, when you get down to verse 28, and he uses the same language with respect to humanity, that it's a blessing expressed toward humanity. What that means is that verse 28 is not giving us an obligation that we are required to go out and fulfill. There is no cultural mandate. Having said that, because this is God's blessing, I think it does describe the capacities with which humanity is created and according to which God intends for humanity to function. We don't need a command to go out and be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. You know what? We did that without a command. And we did it very effectively. The earth is pretty well full these days. Okay, there are still a few corners in Montana that could take a few more people. Maybe remove a few of them from Chicago, I don't know. But God gave us the capacity. We fulfilled the capacity in accordance with his blessing. Same thing when it comes to subduing, exercising dominion. To say that this is not a command does not mean that the statement is irrelevant to us. This is what God designed us to do. God designed us to subdue the earth. By the way, if you understand what that means, that has a heavy impact on your ecology. We are not here to preserve the earth. We are here to subdue the earth. Same term that's used of Ahasuerus in the book of Esther when he sees that Haman has cast himself at Esther, and Ahasuerus infers that Haman is attempting to rape Esther. Same term that's used here. He's trying to subdue her. We're told to subdue the earth. Pretty forceful term. Okay? So we are intended to subdue the earth, we are intended to exercise dominion, but I don't think we have to go out and try to do that as if it's some command. Rather, it's hardwired into us. It's what we are. It's what it means to be a human being. It's what it means to be made in the image of God. This is the way we function. Okay? Now, let me draw a comparison. Dr. Macagina, a while ago, was talking about birds singing by instinct. You think about it, most animals have instincts built into them according to which they process their environment. How does a monarch butterfly know to fly to Mexico? Well, nobody ever teaches it. It's just built into the butterfly. How do geese know to fly south for the winter? Nobody ever teaches them. They just know how to do it. How does a bird know how to build a nest? Nobody ever teaches it. It's built in. It's instinct. God gives to animals instincts as ways of guiding them through their environment. Animals don't have the brains to stop and think about everything, and so God makes certain responses automatic for them. God has not given to human beings any instincts of which I am aware. God has not given us those built-in ways of processing our environment. And the problem is, there's a lot of environment there. There's a lot that reaches us through our sensation. I mean, you stop and think about the things that are happening and the things that are present just in the room where we are right now. You're paying attention to the sound of my voice, most of you. Even Todd is right now. Paying attention to the sound of my voice. But how many sounds in the room are you not hearing while you're listening to me? At the moment, you're looking at me, most of you. A couple of you have your eyes shut. We'll overlook that. You're looking at me. You're seeing me. How many other things in the room are you not seeing while you're looking at me? How many of the things in this room that you might have seen Have you simply overlooked during the whole time that you've been here? Did you notice the tulips in the stained glass window? Personally, I sort of wish they were just tulips, but that's another topic. You see, you pay attention to certain things and you have to ignore certain other things. Think of the things that you're noticing with your sense of touch. Some of you, you know, are noticing the hard back of the pew. Others of you are enjoying the nice deep cushioning on the pew. But think of what you're not feeling. You know, are you noticing the way that your shoes feel on your feet right now? Or the weight of your shirt on your shoulders? Well, most of you aren't. You do when I mention it. Now you notice it. The number of sensations that are coming at us constantly are just innumerable. If we had to process all of that stuff deliberately and rationally, we would just shut down. We wouldn't be able to do it. Animals have instincts to help guide them through all that stuff. We don't have any instincts. One way of understanding culture is that we take our God-given capacity for order, for subduing and arranging the world, for exercising dominion, and we work together in such ways that we develop a shared pattern of how the world fits together. And then we transmit that to our children, not deliberately, but just by virtue of the way that we walk through the world. And as we grow up, I mean, you and I, we weren't the ones who invented this pattern. But as we grow up within a particular pattern, we learn to see and to process the world according to the pattern in which we are reared. That pattern is what we call a culture. So a culture, I'm suggesting under point D, is a secondary environment that's humanly created that essentially embodies an explanation of reality. Now, that's more than just religion, but it's never less than your religion. Your culture is always going to include and to incarnate your entire religious view of the world, who God is, who you are, what the world is, why the world has been created. All of that is going to be bound into your culture. Culture provides a grid for interpreting the apparently random data of sensation. So culture is a system of meaning that helps you make sense of the world. It's a way of knowing that transfers the shared perspectives of a particular group of people to people who are now entering that group, usually to the young who grow up in that group, but sometimes secondarily to people who enter the group from outside. That's what I have in mind when I'm talking about culture. Obviously, different cultures are going to embody different perspectives and different ways of processing reality. Another way of saying it is to suggest that different religions are going to produce different cultures. Or irreligion will produce its own kind of culture. I'd like to suggest under main point two that there are at least two forces that are at work in every culture. And these are forces to which Dr. Macagina has already alluded. I'm not going to spend a lot of time developing these because I think you already understand what they are. Number one is human depravity. And Dr. Macagina well stated, and I'm glad he made the case, that human depravity touches every aspect of our being. It affects the way that we think, it affects the way that we choose, and it affects our emotional state. It affects what we love and what we hate. And that's why we call it total depravity, because it affects every area of our being. It doesn't mean that we're as bad as we can be. It does mean that everything that can be touched by sin has been touched by sin. And that's true not only of us as individuals, it is true of every network of meaning that we put together to help us navigate through the world. That is to say, because we are depraved creatures, we insert depravity into every culture that we make. But there is also a second element that is present in every culture, and that is the element of common grace. Common grace is the idea that God has not entirely abandoned humankind. He has not just left us to the ravages of sin, but he has, even in a fallen world, apart from his special revelation and apart from saving grace, built in certain barriers that keep things from becoming as bad as they can be. He does good to all human beings. He displays his beneficence toward all human beings. And he has built into his world certain phenomena that will help to stem the worst manifestations of sin. For example, human government is God's creation. Now, human governments can be very, very bad governments. But even a bad government is better than no government. Even a sinful government is far superior to anarchy when you have simply the rule of the strongest. That's part of God's common grace. And there are other ways in which God, I think, manifests his common grace in every culture and every civilization, every society that exists. Now, there is a third element that is present within some cultures, and that is redeeming grace and revealed truth. In addition to the common grace that is present naturally in all cultures, to some greater or less degree, there will be present within some cultures the influence of the special revelation of Scripture and the message of the gospel. And as revelation and as the gospel affects people, alters their state of mind, changes their hearts, then it is also going to affect the culture in which those people live. It will change the terms of the culture to the extent that it is persuasive among a great number of people. By the way, I think it's important to underline here. There are two mistakes that you can make when you talk about culture. These tie to the two extremes of Niebuhr's typology of ways to approach culture. You remember the Anabaptist view, we reject all culture? That is tied to an understanding of culture that equates culture with the world. And since we are opposed to the world, then we are opposed to all culture. By the way, we do sometimes make that mistake. Particularly, we fundamentalists have been prone to make that mistake with respect to high culture. Arts, letters, philosophy, jurisprudence, etc. We have tended to write that all off as the world. We have tended to say we don't want to have anything to do with that. And we have tried to insulate ourselves from it. Some of you remember a day, and it's gone now, I think, or at least going, when there was in our circles a fair amount of contempt toward higher education. In fact, it was regularly called edumacation. If you wanted to be a minister, you were encouraged not to go off to cemetery where they would mess you all up. Okay? There is in that attitude a certain kind of contempt for higher culture that I think turns on this confusion between culture and world. Culture is not the same thing as the world. The world is part of what culture becomes when it sets itself against God. But not everything in any culture is the world. The other confusion that you can make is the liberal confusion, which views culture as being God, or I think a more refined version of the same confusion is the one that some Reformed theologians commit. I'm tempted to mention the name of Michael Scott Horton here, but probably I shouldn't. Who tend to think, they tend to view culture as divinely created. Culture is part of God's creation, and therefore all of culture is good, and all of culture should be enjoyed and absorbed. I don't think either of those is right. Either to dismiss culture as completely evil, or to affirm culture as completely good. The truth is somewhere in between, because every culture has at least the two elements of common grace, but human depravity. Now, if you throw into culture the third element of redeeming grace and revealed truth, this does not mean that everybody in the culture needs to get saved in order for the culture to change. What it does mean is that people who accept a Christian view of the world must be in the position of articulating and shaping the cultural ideal. More on that in a moment. All of that leads me to say this. I do think it's possible to form judgments about cultures. Not about culture in the abstract, but about particular cultures. Some cultures are better than other cultures. Let's think about two cultures. One is a culture shaped by Nazi ideals. The other is a culture shaped, let's say, by Keswick ideals. Now, many of you in this room may not have much sympathy either for Nazism or for Keswickism. But given a choice, I suspect that you would much rather live under Keswick culture than you would like to live under Nazi culture. You may not like either one very much, but you're going to recognize that at least one is better than the other. Not only that, you're going to recognize that some particular phenomena within each culture are going to be better than others. So you not only have to evaluate cultures as a whole, you have to evaluate specific phenomena within those cultures. There are evidences of common grace within even the very worst cultures. Think of Nazi culture for a moment. The Nazis had a really good work ethic. They worked hard, and they were committed to what they believed. That's virtuous in and of itself. Of course, it was turned to an abysmally evil end, and so it worked great calamity in the long run. The point is, there was something that was good there. On the other hand, I don't think the fact that there was something that was good there is going to lead many of us to want to appropriate Nazi culture as a whole, or even specific parts of it, especially those parts which symbolize or emblematize the Nazi ideal. What it boils down to is this. If we're going to evaluate cultures, since cultures are systems of meaning, and since cultural phenomena within those cultures are communicators of meaning and transmitters of meaning, what we have to learn to do is to parse meaning within culture and on the part of cultural phenomena. Now, Dr. Macagina was talking about part of that for the last hour. He's talking about the fact that music conveys meaning. And I appreciate the carefulness that he adopts in saying, here is not how it conveys meaning, and here's how it does convey meaning. Too often, the stuff that comes out of fundamental presses doesn't make those careful distinctions, and it ends up being simply ridiculous. We don't do ourselves any service by putting forth bad arguments. Let's talk for a moment about meaning. If we're going to parse meaning in culture, we have to understand what meaning is. And I'm going to suggest for you, this is in the middle of page 18, four different levels at which a thing may carry meaning. And it's important to be able to distinguish these. First level is the strictly ascriptive or stipulative level. What I mean by that is that a particular meaning is simply and deliberately attached to a particular thing. The military is good at this. You know, all of the military acronyms have no real grounding in reality. They are simply designations. They are shorthand to stand for big concepts. The counterculture of the 60s and 70s was good at this. There was a certain meaning that was attached to bell-bottom pants. Some of you are old enough to remember this. Those of you who aren't, you missed a really fun period of history. Or facial hair on men. There was a scriptive meaning that was attached to wearing facial hair if you were a man. I can still remember when I enrolled in Bible college. It was against the rules for men to have facial hair. They never defined that so as to include eyebrows that I know of. But you weren't allowed to have a beard or a mustache or, for a while at least, even very long sideburns. Of course, over the time, because that was a purely stipulative meaning. In fact, it was a stipulative meaning that was actually contrary to the intrinsic meaning of the thing. Parenthesis, Augustine argues that a beard is part of male beauty and that we will all have beards in the eternal state. End parenthesis. Those of you who are Augustinians, you can file this away for future reference. Because of the fact that this was a purely stipulative meaning, it faded very quickly. So now we've got a few guys in the room today who are wearing beards, and it's no big deal, right? Second level of meaning is associational meaning. Dr. Macagina talked about this one as the "they're playing our song" level of meaning. You know, this was the particular music that was playing when, you know, they announced that my dad didn't survive cardiac surgery. And forever after, when I hear this song, I think of how sad those moments were. Okay, there is a level of meaning that is conveyed that way. Now, that tends to be a very personal level of meaning. That song will probably mean that to you every time you hear it, or it will signify that to you, might be a better way to put it. Whenever you hear it, it's a very Pavlovian view of meaning. The meaning won't communicate to anybody else who didn't share the same experience. And it's nothing intrinsic to the song. If somebody blew a foghorn while the announcement was being made, you'd probably feel that way every time you heard a foghorn. You know, if somebody was shooting an M50 at the time that the announcement was made, you'd probably feel that way every time you heard a machine gun. Okay, there's nothing intrinsic to the thing itself. It's purely associative, but it does carry a certain level of meaning, at least for the people who get the association. A fourth level of meaning is conventional. This is like associative meaning in that it isn't really grounded in the thing itself, but it's shared across an entire culture. Most of our language is conventional in nature. Now, parts of our language are grounded in metaphysical reality. Parts of our language may be purely stipulative or associative, but most of our spoken and written language is conventional. And you flout the convention at your own peril. This is exactly what Lewis Carroll is writing about in Through the Looking Glass when he has Alice confront Humpty Dumpty. And Humpty Dumpty says, I can make words mean whatever I want them to mean, and if I change their meaning, I pay them overtime for doing double duty. Well, we recognize intuitively that if everybody did that, all language would become impossible. No communication would occur any longer. And so there is some conventional level of meaning that is absolutely essential to human existence. And then beyond that, of course, the fourth level of meaning is meaning that is intrinsic. That is to say, it is grounded in metaphysical reality. And I hope that we have time to get back to that one. But all I'm saying now is that that is a level of meaning. Not every meaning is purely conventional. Take the issue of clothing, for example. At some levels, what clothing communicates may be purely associative. It may be purely stipulative. I may not recognize even what a particular kind of clothing communicates, especially if it's new and trendy. At some level, clothing is conventional in the meanings that it communicates. But at some level, the meaning of clothing is grounded in metaphysical reality. We have a variation in the way that people are dressed here today. All of us are operating within the broad confines of a particular convention. If somebody came and sat down in this assembly who was manifesting a dramatically different convention, they would probably get our attention very quickly. I preached in India, traveled in India, taught and preached in India last November. And in India, you don't wear shoes in church. In fact, you really shouldn't even wear socks. So I went barefoot. It was a lot of fun. I enjoyed it. I just as soon do it here, but you probably wouldn't appreciate it if I did. It would be a violation of our convention, even though it's their convention. But at some level, our clothing is grounded in metaphysical reality. If somebody came in without clothing, we would all object very loudly. And we would insist that clothing, the lack of clothing does have significance. Whatever the culture, whatever the circumstance, it does have significance. And it would not be a significance that we would want communicated in this auditorium. Particularly if that someone was built like me. Nobody wants to see that. Okay? So, you've got different levels of meaning. And you know, it doesn't always matter which level the meaning is communicating at. What matters is that the meaning is communicating. Let's go on and talk for a moment about Western culture, Western civilization, because I said earlier that there is the possibility in some cultures that an entire culture can be influenced by redeeming grace and revealed truth. This has actually happened in the orbit of cultures known as Western cultures. I'm not suggesting that they ever were Christian cultures. Nor am I suggesting that they have retained the influence of revealed truth that they once had. But there was a time when the cultures of Western Europe were very strongly influenced by Christian categories. And I'm giving you an outline of it here. Let's talk about the medieval consensus. During the Middle Ages, virtually everyone within medieval society viewed the world in certain categories. And here are the categories, the content. Number one, they all believed in a personal God who is interested in his creatures and who intervenes in history, either miraculously or providentially. So you've got a personal, infinite, transcendent, but immanent God. They all believed, or if they didn't believe, at least they understood the concept of a moral universe, governed by God's moral law, in which moral violation leads to retribution. They understood that. Most of them believed it. They understood, see, the concept of human sinfulness, human finiteness, human dependency. They knew that we were small, that we were sinful, that we were limited. They had a sense that divine help was necessary and divine forgiveness was indispensable. But that was balanced by a vision of human dignity that was grounded in the idea that we people had been made in the image of God. This was widely shared across Western civilization. There was a vision of Jesus Christ as the God-man, a belief in Jesus Christ as the God-man, the unique revealer of the Father and the redeemer of mankind. That was virtually universal in Western Europe of the Middle Ages. There was a shared belief in the necessity of faith and of religion, a shared recognition of the presence of mystery, and a shared deference to the prestige of Scripture and of the Church as authorities. There wasn't always agreement about what constituted the Church, but there was agreement that whatever it was, the Church occupied a privileged place in society. And there was a shared agreement that the social order ought to reflect the divine order and the divine authority. And you can trace this through the political history of the Middle Ages, from feudalism to the divine right of kings to the rule of law. It all grows out of the attempt to implement a biblical worldview into the political sphere. Now, I don't think you can quite call that a Christian culture or a Christian civilization, but obviously it's a culture that is profoundly impacted by Christian categories. Christian maybe with a small c and in quotations, they could get pretty messed up on the way of salvation sometimes, but I note that out of the various versions of Christianity that were exported to various cultures, Byzantine Christianity, Marcionite Christianity, etc., the only one that ever succeeded in producing a Reformation was the version of Christianity that was planted in Western Europe. Something true was there. And that true thing became dominant to the point that during the Middle Ages, at least the institutional church functioned as the arbiter of culture. It was the church and its thinkers and its preaching and its music that set the pace both for formal high culture and for the folk cultures. All of that begins to change with the rise of nominalism in the late Middle Ages, and especially with the dominance of William of Ockham as a philosopher. Beginning with nominalism and extending through the invention of popular culture in the first third of the 19th century, you have the disillusion of this Christian worldview as a dominant view within culture. You move from a theocentric universe to an anthropocentric universe in which God is viewed either as absent, deism, as impersonal, pantheism, or even as non-existent, atheism, in which the universe is governed by scientific laws, in which morality is reduced to a contract, Locke, Rousseau, in which anthropology emphasizes human autonomy, human ability, human goodness, equality, freedom, progress, liberté, égalité, fraternité, in which Jesus Christ is viewed as a good man or a big brother at best, or maybe even as a pious fraud, in which the final appeal is always to reason, and reason is sufficient, whether that's understood as rational deduction, Descartes, Spinoza, Leibniz, or as empirical experience, Locke, Berkeley, Hume. One way or another, reason is sufficient. It's the final court of appeal. And so doubt rather than belief becomes the primary category. Mystery, miracle, tradition, authority, they are all either questioned or rejected. And the social order is redesigned to reflect human equality, rationality, fraternity, and liberty. Those become the operating ideals of civilization. And once this takes place, culture breaks free of the domination of Christian categories. You've still got institutional Christianity operating at one level, but now high culture breaks off and goes in its own direction, beginning with philosophy, moving through the arts, jurisprudence, music, It goes off in its own direction. And then along about 1830, you've got the invention of something that had never existed in the world before that time, popular culture. By the way, when you hear people say that Martin Luther borrowed tunes from popular culture, the moment you hear someone say that, you should recognize you're talking to a person who doesn't have a clue what he's discussing. There was no popular culture in Martin Luther's day. In fact, there was no secularity in Martin Luther's day. Martin Luther is still operating under the medieval consensus. You don't have secularism until the Enlightenment. You don't have popular culture until the invention of the steam-powered printing press during the 1830s. Popular culture is mass culture. It is mass-produced. And it's intrinsically secular, and it's intrinsically debasing because it caters to people's appetites. Popular culture is all about what will sell. Now, of course, not all popular culture has been equally bad. You begin with Victorian and Edwardian popular culture, which is very, very sentimental and individualized. And then you move, music almost becomes a kind of a metaphor for the various cultural shifts. You move into the Jazz Age with flappers and all the rest. That represents a step downward. Then you move into the rock era beginning in the 1950s. Another step downwards culturally in terms of civilization. And then sometime during the 1980s, you take another thump downward into what you could call the rap era. I still like rock, I've got to admit that. That doesn't mean I approve of it. But if I sit and listen to it, I do enjoy it. Rap, hip-hop, I've got to say my only exposure is when I'm sitting at the stoplight, and some guy pulls up beside me. But I can't say I've learned to enjoy it. I do think you find clear shifts in popular culture. You listen to what they were saying in jazz songs. Listen to what they were saying in rock songs. There's definitely a step down there. Even if you're just listening to the lyrics, leaving aside the music per se. Listen to what they're saying in hip-hop these days. And you wonder, is there any way that it can get much worse? And frankly, I can't think of very many ways that it can. So popular culture is off on a tangent of its own. But you see, all of this created a huge problem for Christianity. The problem is this. For literally centuries, Christianity, the church, quote-unquote, institutionally speaking, has been setting the pace for culture. Now, high culture has taken off into secularism. Popular culture has taken off in its own direction, which ends up in secularism, and very debased secularism at that. And all of a sudden, Christianity simply seems foreign. So what can you do? And there are only three answers to that. Answer number one, within the church, you continue to grow and perpetuate the same kind of things that you have been doing all the way along. That's conservatism. Answer number two, you attach the success of the church to the now secular high culture. That's what we call modernism, and it begins in Europe with Friedrich Schleiermacher, and it begins in the United States officially with Horace Bushnell. Answer number three, you attach the fortunes of institutional Christianity to popular culture. By the way, Finney serves as the fulcrum in the United States for the move both to secular higher culture and the move to secular popular culture. Finney's followers went in two directions. Some of them became theological modernists. Some of them became religious populists. So you've got this chain: Finney, Moody, Bliss, Sankey, Crosby, Doan, Sunday, Norris, Graham, Wurtzen, Carmichael, Husted. And you get down in the 1970s to Larry Norman, the inventor of what we now call CCM. Back in those days, it was called Christian rock. Larry Norman, am I getting the name right? Why should the devil have all the good music? I want the people to know that he saved my soul, but I still like to listen to the radio. They tell me rock and roll is wrong. We'll give you one more chance. I say, I feel so good, I got to get up and dance. That's Larry Norman. Okay? They're all doing essentially the same thing, and that is attaching Christianity to secular, popular culture, trying to win respect for the Christian faith by putting it in the terms that ordinary people are using in their lives as they are being exposed to the politicians and advertisers. Now, when that move was first made in Victorian culture, it didn't seem so bad. We had to, you know, sentimentalize Christianity. We had to individualize Christianity. There was a shift away from God and his perfections toward how I feel. But it didn't seem so bad at the time. When the Jazz Age came, there were many who wouldn't make that jump into the Jazz Age. I think it's arguable that those who did make the jump into the Jazz Age were the people who became known as the neo-evangelicals. When the Rock Age came, many of the aforementioned would not make the jump into the Rock Age. Those who did are the ones who became known as the evangelical left. And now we're faced with the era of rap and hip-hop. And of course, evangelicalism today is making that shift, and we don't know yet what it's going to look like when it's fully wrought. What we do know is that for the ones who tried to stop back with Victorian and Edwardian culture, you know, they said, we're not going to sing the Wurzen stuff. We're going to stay back here with Crosby and Doan and Sankey. It was like holding themselves suspended in midair by an act of sheer will. They were no longer attached to the historic forms of the church. They no longer understood what Watts or Wesley or Newton or Cowper were trying to say. But at the same time, they were just as irrelevant to the surrounding culture as if they were singing Gregorian chant. In fact, they were less relevant because nothing seems sillier than what has just gone out of style. So if you're living in a jazz era and you're singing Fanny Crosby, people look at you and they go, huh? So let's suppose you make the next jump and now you're going to bring in, you know, the jazz era choruses into your church. You know, Safe Am I, Christ for Me. Those are the ones I grew up with. How about you? It represents the jump into the next stage. What happens when the culture shifts into the rock era? Well, those things seem terribly blasé. So what you need next is He's Everything for Me, which was a sort of a grudging half-concession to the new popular music. You know, Ralph Carmichael and Husted, they were the halfway house to CCM. But when the culture makes the next shift, you're just as irrelevant as if you had stayed with Gregorian chant. In fact, you're worse than if you had stayed with Gregorian chant. By the way, I'm not advocating that we should be doing Gregorian chant in our services. Don't get me wrong. Okay, you're worse than that because you're just as irrelevant. You know, what does the culture want today? Well, if you're doing what the culture wanted 5 years ago, you're just as irrelevant. You're worse than irrelevant. You're unstylish. You're not with the times. If you're going to attach the inner culture of the church to popular culture, there is no way to retain relevance if you ever, ever put the brakes on. At some point, you are going to be faced with a choice. Either I will become immoral or I will become irrelevant. And you know what? That brings me to the end of my time. So I'm going to stop. If you're thinking, what's the solution here? That's a really good question. But I'm going to stop. And I think the solution will come as we all think together about that question. And we learn to be critical about perhaps some of the things we've been guilty of perpetuating.